Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio's Labyrinths in the News. Today is the 16th day of the Galactic Hawk Moon of Integrity, Selly Root Chakra Blue Resonant Eagle Day. The affirmation is, I channel in order to create inspiring mind. I seal the output of vision with the resonant tone of attunement. I am guided by the power of accomplishment. And, of course, it's the Gregorian calendar day of Monday, February 22nd, 2010. I'm your host, Christiana, coming to you live from the Couve. That's Vancouver, Washington, across the river from Portland, Oregon, as I will be doing most every Monday at 3:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, or Pacific Time. My leading music is the first cut off of Susan Alexander's CD Sequentia, called Icos, E-I-K-O-S, which is short for icosahedron, the water symbol in sacred geometry. Sequentia is music using tones recorded from DNA vibrations. Susan recorded these tones in 1988 with the help of Dr. David Diemer, at that time a cell biologist at the Davis campus of the University of California. If any of you would like to chat while we are on the air, please go to christiana-anea@blogtalkradio.com. My guest today is Russell Hill, who is a technical consultant for the 2009 Labyrinth Society Gathering and Convention, and is a videographer who has filmed Labyrinth events in the Portland, Oregon area. Thank you, Russell, for joining me today.
Thank you, Christiana, for having me on your show.
Can you hear me fine?
I can. Can you hear me?
Okay, you're a little soft, but I'm afraid of turning me up because I've been told that I'm too loud and my guests are not loud enough. So
let's try this. Is that better?
Yes, that's much better. You closer to your mic? Or great, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Well, speaking of sound, let's find out a little bit about your background in your technical background in sound and film and et cetera, and what you how when and how did you hear the call of the Labyrinth?
Well, the Labyrinth is one of many routes that we go down in life, and we come into that various ways. Mine would be, my first experience was about 10, 12 years ago in Ithaca, New York, at a garden labyrinth at a B&B that my wife and I stayed at. So I would say technically she introduced me to the labyrinth, and I'm very grateful for that. As a videographer, I go back there about 15 years as well, mostly involved with public access television, and based upon some very positive childhood experiences of being on television, that led me to the current state that I practice it nearly full time.
And so you have a business that you, your own business?
Long Light Productions, based here in Portland, Oregon, doing videography, documentaries primarily, as well as art videos, and I currently work part-time in television production.
Okay. So you said that you walked, did you know what it was that you were walking when your wife introduced you to it up there in Ithaca?
Yes.
Did you you understood what...
Well, as much as we do understand the labyrinth, yes, I had read some things about it, and as she mentioned, this particular B&B, that's why we went there, so I investigated a little bit and came to embrace it.
And so after that, when you came back, you lived on the in Pacific Northwest for a while, you and your wife. And so did you walk when you came back? You started walking Labyrinth here. How did you get involved with the gathering? I mean, how did that labyrinthine path happen?
Initially here in the Portland area, I had met Dr. Schroeder, who is a very, very active participant of the Labyrinth. And from there, I met various people that are practitioners. And there was an opportunity to volunteer for the 2009 Labyrinth Gathering, and I raised my hand and said, I will help. So that's how that all came about.
Yep.
Short version.
Okay. So I know, I mean, because I was on the committee, and I know that you sort of came in sort of at the tail end of after I did. I mean, although you might have been in touch with them before that, but really your services were required more towards the end of the planning once we all got everything all put down on paper and understood where, how many workshops there were going to be and what the venue was and what that was all about. So when you joined, what were some of the technical concerns facing this committee for this three-day event and the pre-gathering lectures? What did you face when you first came on board?
A multitude of variations in the presenters' computers and software. That was probably the biggest unknown that we had to face. The venue itself created numerous challenges because of things that we would normally find in other venues that would support our gathering, such as projection screens, video projectors, public address systems, and the like.
So the venue, because it was a hotel and a restaurant, what you're saying is that they didn't have a lot of that kind of equipment available to use at the for the event?
Well, yeah, similar to that, I came to understand that this particular venue catered to weddings more than conferences. A conference center is going to have projectors, screens, public address systems, whiteboards with markers, and the tools necessary to put on a good conference, where a wedding venue needs a dance floor and good food and accommodations. So the venue itself was, and it was a fine place, everyone enjoyed themselves, but they lacked in their specialty, or we did not have that understanding on the front end. So it made things a little interesting, and it all worked out, but it's all these things have their challenges, but that's part of the excitement.
So you were faced with, first of all, let's describe the venue itself, because this is very helpful, I think, for people planning Labyrinth gatherings. I mean, first you have a very specific criteria for Labyrinth gatherings, period, right? So how about talking a little bit about Labyrinth gatherings in particular, rather than just some type of other convention where you just have people just speaking up in front of the room. With Labyrinth gatherings, for this particular one, for Labyrinth Society gatherings, you will have, what, 10 different or so different workshop presenters, as well as the main presenters, and they all are in different spaces, and some of them are doing things at the same time in different rooms, and in this particular venue, you had a number of different buildings that you had to deal with, too, not just rooms, but buildings themselves. Can you speak to all of that? And how did you coordinate all of that?
Well, I will say I would like to give credit to the other team members, because there was a lot of work going into creating the schedules and assigning the rooms, which was a challenge because some people needed a lot of room. And this would be a high point worth noting for other types of events, or the future Labyrinth events, where you need space for labyrinths. And there were a number of indoor labyrinths that needed the largest rooms that this particular venue had to offer. So that was really important to coordinate that. Understood?
Yeah. And so you had workshop presenters needing large amounts of space as well as a place where they could also give a talk. So they had to. So tell us a little bit about the sound issues. I mean, the venue itself was challenging because you had many different rooms that were spread out over the. I mean, it wasn't just in one building. You had to go to different buildings and make sure that each workshop could work in a particular space that was it was assigned, and then you had to make sure that the workshop presenter gave you all the information that they needed so that they you had. I mean, I remember with one of the presenters, we thought that they could use a small labyrinth, and it turned out that they wanted a full size Chart labyrinth on the floor. So. So that was a sort of a traffic problem, I guess. But tell us a little bit about the sound issues and what you faced with the miking and all of that with the different rooms.
By and large, most of the workshops were small enough that the presenters were comfortable with just directly speaking to their group of 15, 20 people. The theater, as I recall, had a small PA system in it, which worked out very well, even though I understand there were people there, again, who did not utilize it because there was an intimate crowd and the workshops could carry on just fine. The main presentation hall, the central point of the entire event, had a very limited PA system, and interfacing some of the laptops into it was quite problematic. Unknowns to me and the folks putting on the presentation, people showing up at the last minute with things that are untested and unclear, so we kind of had to fast dance to make things work and get a fairly decent sound out. I felt that because of the way the room was set up, there was not a good representation of the PA system throughout the room, meaning the people in the back of the room did not have the same quality of audio as those sitting up front. And this was just inherent in the venue's equipment.
And this was the room where people ate too. Is this the same room as you're talking? That's the room you're talking about?
Yes, it is. It's where we had all of our meals. So tables had to get set up. Tables had to get taken apart. There was a continuous moving of that furniture because we would have breakfast there, and we would have lunch there, and we would have dinner there. And in between those times, there were events going on in that space.
So that was a difficult juggling right there, because you didn't have specific space that was set aside for the main presentations where you knew that you could set up the mics and the sound system and it would stay.
Correct. And the same for the projection, because we had to move the screen out of the way, so that meant when we set it back up, we had to readjust everything from the beginning, and I feel that it came off. I think the video came off very well. Actually, there were some audio issues that were beyond our control, but that's part of the nature of that beast.
So you talked about the computer issues. So people would come with PCs and with Macs, and you would have to know what equipment you needed for what?
Yes. Basically, it was a cabling issue because the Mac, and even in the Mac world, there are 10-plus different connections that are available between a particular laptop and a LCD projector. So making sure we had all of those which we did do. We had very good help there, but you have to take the time to make sure you have the cable and make sure that it's all good connection and that the projector is talking to the Mac. And then the PC, that's more straightforward as far as the physical connection. But then again, you had to make sure that it worked. We had one presenter who I spent well over an hour with because she could not find her presentation. And it wound up that she had created this on a standalone computer, a desktop computer with a much bigger screen. So when she closed her program, her presentation, it was off the screen. And her laptop was really tiny screen. So once we figured that out, oh, here it is, that's fine, it worked beautifully. But it took, you know, you had to spend the time to make it work, and that's part of what I was there to do. That was my job, essentially, so I have no complaints. It was a great experience and a great opportunity for me to actually build a new friendship with this person and her spouse, and it's a very good thing, very good thing. But you have to be patient and sit there and do it because you don't want those things happening as they go up to do their presentation.
So in preparation for this event, you, along with the rest of the planning committee, had to, none of this equipment, so the people didn't, they brought their computers, but many of them didn't bring projectors, they didn't bring cables, and you had to, along with the you had to figure out, along with the workshop person who was in charge of this, who needed what and what kind of equipment you needed. Now, this was all, you had to go and find this in various locations around the Portland area?
Yes, yes. I spent some time on the Internet and just doing some research, and there was one member on the committee whose partner works in a industry of audiovisual presentations, and I talked with them a little bit, and we wound up doing all of our business with that particular firm, and they had everything we needed that we could source in that amount of time, and they were very gracious also in their support for us. But I probably researched 20 different websites for parts and pricing, and it's part of what you do.
And had you ever done anything like this before?
Yes.
Event?
Yes. No. Not with Labyrinth, but with video and audio production, yes. In fact, remote television production, this is very, very similar to that kind of work, other than you don't have cameras. But everything else is very, very similar. You're working with people, you're working with materials, you're working with third parties and fourth parties, meaning like the venue and their staff and their staff. So I have had experience with this.
And so tell us a little bit about now the lighting for, you know, obviously most of these, this is fairly straightforward inside, but you did have outside labyrinths that were on the grounds. And tell us a little bit about the lighting for that area, for that space, because you had nighttime events going on there, correct?
Yes, yes. First, let me say we had three incredible labyrinths outdoors at the 2009 labyrinth event. It was just amazing. We primarily used clear, I'll call them holiday season lights, that were draped into the trees and around a couple of small canopies that we had. But also, we outlined two of the labyrinths with lights directly on the ground. So we had lots of heavy-duty extension cords and lots of people helping as well, that we actually pegged these lights to the ground along the outline of the labyrinth to make it very clear to anyone who would have been out there at night to not only see it from a safety standpoint, but to be able to walk and enjoy the labyrinth, plural, the labyrinth.
And the one, the Janessa labyrinth, though, she had her own, and Sula had her own way of of lighting that those tubes and things, right? She brought that.
Yes, and that is a part of that labyrinth. She uses solar-powered battery charger to support that entirely. We did have to give her a feed for her backup system, and that worked out very well, an electrical feed. But she was self-supported in that respect with her solar power battery charge. It worked out very, very well. And I understand it glowed long into the night.
And now in terms of working with the hotel staff with all this, did they provide the battery charges and everything, or did you have to provide this as well, or did they help with the electrical part?
They helped in the sense that they said you can plug in over here, and that's about it. That's what the venue offered us. We supplied, through various volunteers within the organization, supplied extension cords for us to use for the event. We probably had close to 24 50-foot and longer extension cords, and I believe some people even purchased a couple just to make sure that we had electricity out there.
Wasn't there music, musicians playing? What did you have to do for them?
Well, we provided electrical service to them, plus the lighting in the canopy, so that they could be seen while they're performing. And that's pretty much all that they needed, as far as inside, outside, when they were playing outdoors. Inside, there was electricity already set up, and they were self-sufficient with their, at least in theory from what I understand, their own amplifiers and their own PA system. They brought all of that, and they just used the electrical service there already provided.
And did you have to get involved at all with any kind of sound or lighting issues with the marketplace that was there as well?
No. They used house light. There wasn't any specific lighting situation for them. Through the daytime, they had fabulous daylight. It was an amazingly clear weekend, so they had great direct sunshine. And at night, the house lights seemed to serve their needs just fine. And no one ever approached me about needing electricity or lighting at all for the vendors.
And so what else did you do? So you did sound and lighting for the event and made sure that people, if they needed it, well, you did have now during the lunch times and dinner when there were, you did have some mic'd necessary mic situations with Eunice, with Dr. Schroeder, when she had to make announcements. So was that equipment that you had rented for her to talk to everybody during when everybody was in one place eating at the end of the...
No, that was part of it. That was the sound equipment of the venue, and that was it. They had two speakers and a microphone. That was it. And I would just turn it on for her is all I would do at that point. That's all she needed was microphone turned on, and she made her announcements, and that was it. But
so tell us, you have any wonderful experiences you want to share about this event, doing this event at all?
Let's see. Well, I walked a number of wonderful labyrinths myself. It was a great experience, made some new friends. It was a pleasure working with the committee. I was very, very glad to be a part of it, and I learned a whole lot, including some new things about myself and other people. And I can say that the outdoor labyrinth at night was pretty incredible. And as I understand, the pathways were visible some days after the labyrinths were removed, which I think is a very nice testimony to the event that it has a lasting effect and a lasting value for what it is. And I believe that there's a Zen saying that if after 3 days you still get it, then you actually got it. So I think if the grass, the worn grass was there beyond 3 days, then I think that we as a Labyrinth community have said something to the greater audience of life.
So are you currently involved with any Labyrinth work now?
Nothing full-time. I have a video project that I have started. It's ever so slowly coming together. And occasionally I get to a beach and I will create some temporary labyrinths there in the sand. And that is what I'm actively involved in with labyrinths.
So the picture that you sent me, the photo that you sent me, that's you walking the labyrinth on the beach?
Yes. Yeah.
And what kind of labyrinth is that?
That was a seven circuit. Just a simple, actually it was the first labyrinth I ever created in the sand.
Is there a favorite labyrinth that you like in the Portland area?
Oh, my. I like the one at the cathedral. There's not a specific favorite in the Portland area. I like the one at Land's End in San Francisco, and I like the Santa Rosa one in Santa Rosa, but I do not have a favorite here, not yet.
So I'm going to switch gears a little bit, because it's interesting, this other thing that you've done, and I found it fascinating on your website. What's your website again? What's the URL?
It's longlight.net, one word, longlight. .net.
Yeah. And you completed a video, I guess a documentary, of the coastal tribe, and you're going to have to tell me the name of the coastal tribe, in Washington State that still builds totems like their ancestors used to do. What was this like for you, and what will the film be used for?
The experience was actually, let's say it was interesting, challenging, beautiful. And it was what I was looking to get and experience. Working with the carvers was very, very interesting. This project took about 3 years because these poles don't get carved in a couple of days. And at the beginning of the project, after I had the permission of the chairman of the tribe to do this project, the carvers, even though they had given me permission as well, they were a little bit uncomfortable with this guy walking around with the camera all the time. They had no idea who I was. But by the time I was done filming, I think that I had created some very nice and wonderful friendships, and that they came to appreciate my art as much as I appreciate theirs. And that was the reason for my interest, was as an artist and seeing this art form and what it's says of and to people. That was the whole motivation there, was to share that with the public, with anyone who would be interested in hearing about it. So its purpose is educational, and you could almost say an archaeological standpoint, because it is history that is still living. It is still happening. This particular tribe, Jamestown tribe, up in Blinn, Washington, there's very little actual art left from their historic times. So through folk tales and mythology, the creator of these particular poles in this video have created the stories that he then carved into this ancient cedar.
Oh, so this wasn't a regular part of their regular mythology. This was a story that he created from their mythology?
All of those poles are, yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, yes. This tribe, there's only about, I believe, only about 900 actual members left of these people. And just because of their contemporary history, so much of their ancient history has been lost. There's only a few storytellers left who know the myth. All these particular poles are based upon the mythology of these peoples, their myths, their stories.
Where are these poles? Are they up now so anybody can see them?
Oh, yes. I would encourage folks to see them because even though I feel very comfortable about the video, to go stand next to them is a pretty impressive feeling.
Where is it?
They are in Blinn, Washington, which is between Port Townsend and Port Angeles on the Olympic Peninsula. And they are on the tribal government grounds. So and Blinn is like a blink of the eye and you've driven through it. But they are in an area where people can drive to them and see them. They're at the head of Blinn Bay.
Okay, and how do they, is your documentary included in an interior? I mean, how do you hear the documentary? Is that available to the public?
Oh, absolutely. People can contact me at my website. You can order it right from my website. It is available at the Tribal Art Gallery. It's available at their casino, direct through me, and the Smithsonian Institution now has it in their bookstore, their Museum of the American Native Indian.
What was the kind of type of camera, what type of equipment did you use for that?
It was standard definition, digital format. The brand, it's a Canon GL2, which in its day it was a still a very, very fine camera, but it's pre-high definition. But it is a digital format.
And what did you use for sound with it?
What type of microphone?
Well, what type of microphone, but then what did you use for music, or what music did you choose, or is there music, or...
There's very, very little music, that was a choice I made as the producer of it. There are some drumming pieces in it, but I decided to just let the voices and the tools do the singing, essentially. For microphones, I use the on-camera microphone, and I also have some wireless microphones that I used, as well as a shotgun microphone that mounts to my camera. So there was a variety of tools used to capture the audio as time went on, and I purchased more equipment in an effort to produce a better outcome.
So is the tribe happy with the result?
In general, yes. The chairman of the tribe, and I'll quote, it's a very nice piece. It's a very nice video. He is very happy with it.
Good. And so what are you currently working on in your business?
Beyond the Labyrinth project that I have going on, I have been working on a fictional piece, which is really something that I've avoided in the past, but a friend of my wife's wrote a story that just gripped my imagination, and so I'm working on putting it into a film here in the near future. I'll have a dedicated website for it in the near future. I've already built it. I just haven't published it yet. The story's name is Michaela, and it's about the birth of Michaela and her life and her choices about freedom, about being an individual, and about pursuing one's own dreams and living large in life. That's probably a fair way to put it, yes. So those are the big things.
Okay. Well, that sounds interesting. What kind of technical advice can you offer to the people doing the 2010 gathering? I mean, it's going to be in a very different type of venue. It's in New Harmony, Indiana. But do you have any advice for them?
I would say standardize as much as possible. There will only be limited success there, but the more things that can be standardized in the hardware software realm of the presenters, the better. Try to cover as many bases as possible. Have your team willing to help you on a moment's notice, such as I had, which made my job lots easier, and I think it really contributed to the positive outcome of the event. Test your situation, have backups, and be very patient.
Sage advice. Sage advice. I must say.
You know, that's no reason to get upset. Smile.
All right, well.
Work it out. I hope I've answered your questions clearly today, Christiana.
Yeah, thanks, Russell. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure actually working with you at the convention. I mean, you're always there, willing to jump in. Oh, we didn't even talk about that. I mean, you had to, not only did you do the sound and the lighting, but you jumped in and actually helped break down rooms, set up rooms. You helped set up and break down labyrinths for the next workshop people who came in. So you wore a lot of hats actually during those couple of days, as well as you helped out with the pre-gathering presentations, didn't you?
Yes, I did. The gentleman from Scotland.
No, Jim Buchanan.
Yes. I did assist with that as well. Limited capacity. I shot some video for the Labyrinth Network Northwest and turned that over to them. But yes, I was happy to do that and help set up the made sure the PA worked there, and that was part of what I do.
So for people who are planning or contemplating doing this kind of thing or holding an event of like this kind, it is a unique situation working with people who are going to be multiples of people who are going to be offering 60 and 45, 60, 90 minute workshops who want to have either the space to put out their own labyrinths or a space to make a labyrinth, a temporary labyrinth on the floor or on the rug or whatever it is. So there's a number of things that have to go into looking at whether this can be is feasible or not for people who are contemplating this kind of event and having the support and really constant support. I mean, you were working 24/7 during the 3 days. I mean, we called you the Energizer Bunny. You were going all the time, making sure that things were working and making sure that people had what they needed. And there was always something that either was unplugged or not loud enough or, you know, you don't really get the sense. You're very calm right now, Russell, but I remember what it was like during those 3 days. And while we were all trying to be as positive and supportive, there's just little funky glitches that happen. The nature of the beast when you have, and not only that, but the other thing that people need to think about is the kind of venue that is so important. And if you have a brand new building and it's a convention building and everything is all mic'd and already in the walls and everything, how wonderful. But this venue was a very old bunch of buildings.
Yes.
So there was nothing that was high tech or state of the art by any means in these 3 days. And so it was very much jerry-rigged to a large degree, and you really had to fly by the seat of your pants. So it helps to have someone who is sort of a jack-of-all-trades or MacGyver-type person, which I sort of feel like you were, there to just say, okay, yeah, we can make this work, and we can make this work, and we can put this together and make this thing work. And I know
go ahead.
I know personally. I mean, I was made that the middle labyrinth, thinking of it being used during the day and not even thinking about what I would need for nighttime viewing. And those kinds of things, sometimes even when the people who are giving the workshops haven't thought it all out completely. So that's another thing to really think about, that you might be dealing with people who have never given that workshop before, who don't really know what they might not have thought about that they need until they get to the venue, they get to the space, and then it's like, oh my golly, I need this. And so you really came up with some things at the very last minute to make things work, which was it was a really good thing. It was a really good thing. So people need to be aware of that they really have to be willing to jump in, be creative, be flexible, go with the flow, all of that kind of thing to make these kinds of events work, because you're not working with seasoned union, you know, SAG people or anything like that. You're working with people who, you know, might have a passion about labyrinth, but that's all they know, and they don't know anything about sound and lighting.
That's very true. That's very true. I think that,
so.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I think that maintaining a just a really positive attitude, because we everyone involved in this event was there because they wanted to be, because they have a passion about the labyrinth and the participants and the people who practice labyrinth. So having that as one cornerstone of the foundation of the event just dictates that, yeah, we're going to have problems, but it's okay because we'll make it work. It doesn't matter how, and we may not know right now how it's going to work, but we'll make it work. And I believe that we collectively did that. So we were successful in that we did make it work. Was it perfect? No. Would it ever be perfect? Probably not. But are we going to have a good time? Yes, we are. Are we going to share our energy with these other people? Yes, we are. And by maintaining that positive attitude, we collectively, you're included in that we, this team, we made it happen. And I think that makes a big difference right there. I think that every one of us at one time or another said, I don't know how we're going to do it, but we'll do it. And we did it. And I think that any future group of people that do this, if they maintain that going in, they'll have a good event.
Well, thank you so much, Russell, for spending some time with me today. I'm sorry that we didn't get to do this a month and a half ago or whenever it was, but speaking of getting things to work again, I managed to get my computer working again and back on track. So thank you for being patient and going with the flow and being willing to come back as my guest today. It was very, very, it was a good thing, and I think this will be helpful for the people at the 2010 gathering, and so thank you so much for joining me today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my intention to enlighten labyrinth neophytes and support labyrinth veterans with guests like you who provide a depth of information and personal experience not available through other sources. So many blessings on your path. You've been listening to Labyrinths in the News in the live category on blogtalkradio.com with your host, Christiana. Please join me March 1st, when my guest will be Vanessa Compton, the TLS 2010 Workshop Coordinator, as we discuss the guidelines and challenges of creating and submitting a professional workshop proposal and what makes a workshop work and makes a good presenter. So please also check my website and my BTR page for new guests added all the time. Have a blessed in Lakesh.